Tonight we're going to start with TV because it's Friday. The Twisted Tale of Amanda Knox is a drama following the real-life story of American student Amanda Knox, played by Grace Van Patten, who was wrongfully committed of murdering her roommate Meredith Kircher in Italy in 2007. Executive produced by Knox herself, the series traces the 15-year fight to clear her name. Hostage is a British political thriller on Netflix. Saran Jones plays Prime Minister Abigail Dalton, whose husband Alex is kidnapped during a summit meeting with the French president. She simultaneously receives a blackmail threat. The two leaders decide to work together to save Alex and both of their careers and reputations. And finally, the historical drama King and Conqueror depicts the rivalry between former allies Harold Godwinson and William, Duke of Normandy, played by James Norton, and Nikolai Coster-Waldau, their battle for the English throne, which was fueled by ambition and betrayal and then led to the Battle of Hastings in 1066. Lots going on tonight. Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser join me. We'll start with the twisted tale of Amanda Knox. The title of the Disney Plus series reveals quite a lot about it. Jen, yeah, set this up for us.
I mean, I was confused by this title. I mean, I really felt, is this ironic? Like, what are we doing here? Is it making fun of the true crime industry and how we are now treating crimes as entertainment? Because the twisted tale of Amanda Knox, it sounds like Tales of the Unexpected. It sounds like something from Black Mirror. And I think the showrunner, KJ Steinberg, who was part of the writing team of This Is Us, I think she knows exactly what she's doing, because she's basically setting out the stall saying, we are now trash humans for wanting salacious TV like this. And call it what it is and give the audience what they want. And it sounds tacky, and perhaps the tone of the show is a bit tacky, I feel. I mean, we're living in this post-Ryan Murphy universe right now, and everything, our recent history, our recent pop culture history, our recent cultural events, they're all up for grabs. And his tone is very kaleidoscopic. It's very hyper-fantasy. And it also has this wryness to it, this half smirk that we're all supposed to be in on this joke together. And that, for me, set me off course immediately. The tone of this show straight away is really strange. And I do wonder what exactly Amanda Knox is hoping to achieve with this series at all.
Because briefly, remind us again, and I know there may be three or four people who have no sense of who we're talking about here and
sure,
did not hear this story at any point and weren't aware of it. Tell us about the story, because it is about the murder of a young woman.
That's the thing. And I think a lot of the time that gets forgotten about. So, I mean, in 2007, Amanda Knox was basically having that fantasy that a lot of American students live out. She went to live in Italy. She had this roommate, Meredith Kircher, and one night she had another two roommates as well. And one night she comes home, and after being with her boyfriend, Raphael, she comes home and Meredith's door is locked and they find a body in there, and the woman has been killed. And through jigs and reels, and there is a lot of them, she gets involved. When she is taken to the police station and is interviewed, there's a lot to do with the fact that she's unlikable and she's an odd kind of character, and they take against her. And obviously Italian isn't her first language. There's a lot of misunderstandings there. It ends up that she accuses her boss of the murder after a long interviewing process. But she also gets accused as well and ended up in prison for 4 years. And it was this huge miscarriage of justice because they did not have any physical evidence against Amanda Knox.
Okay, let's start with a clip from relatively close to the beginning of the story. This is when Amanda and her boyfriend Raffaele discover that there's been a break-in at the home in Perugia and her friend Meredith's door is locked.
Wait. She's coming. She's okay, coming. She
would look through her thing.
Fuck.
Yeah.
Wait, Meredith. Meredith?
Why isn't it locked?
Hey, Meredith, you in there? Meredith, are you sleeping?
Yeah, she's
hey!
Sleeping through this.
Oh, maybe she has headphones on.
Most possible, she spent the night at British friend.
Hey, Meredith!
Okay, Amanda.
What the fuck?
Okay, call her.
It's Meredith. Leave a message. Have a beautiful day. Ciao.
No.
Keep calling her. I'll be right back.
Where are you going?
I'm checking the downstairs apartment.
Hey, what are you doing?
She might have slept at Giacomo's.
But you said the guys are on holiday.
Well, maybe they came back.
Amanda.
Come on, just keep calling.
Yeah.
I can't see anything. Can you see anything? Anything?
I see a brown purse in the bed.
What? What, her purse is in there?
I can break the door.
Yeah, do that.
Oh, really?
Yes, go.
No, okay.
Jesus.
Now, this is a very strong door.
It's okay.
I doubt she's in there. I call my sister.
Yeah, I'm gonna call my mom. Just...
My sister is police. She will know what to do.
And that's Grace Van Patten as Amanda Knox and Giuseppe Di Domenico as her boyfriend Raffaele in this. Chris, even from the very get-go of episode one, there is a strange tone to this. That kind of potted history of Amanda and her life and her birth at the very beginning. What did you make of this?
I found it appalling, to be honest. I thought the tone at the beginning is so odd, and then it suddenly drops that. So the night that Amanda was out of her apartment, the night that Meredith Carter was murdered in their apartment in Perugia, she was with her boyfriend and they watched Amity, which is one of her favourite films. And for some reason, KJ Steinberg and the creators of the series and the producers, Amanda Knox herself is a producer, thought it would be appropriate to riff on Amity and to actually have the opening section almost be like a scene from that film, which is just all wrong. And I just thought to myself, what are the family of Meredith Carter going to think about this? Because even in the years leading up to this series, when it was first announced, her sister said, I don't know why they are doing this. She told The Guardian last year that it's difficult to understand how this serves any purpose. And I don't think it really does serve any purpose. And I realize some listeners might be saying, well, look, there's been a huge increase. You know, the rise of true crime television is just something that fascinates me. But if we are to have shows like this, I think the very least that you expect is for the producers and people like KJ Steinberg to apply delicacy, respect and professionalism to a case like this. But I don't think they do that. I think they're going for the shock factor. I think, you know, even that title is grossly exploitative, I think. And even when it flashes up on screen at the beginning, the rest of the title disappears and Twisted remains. And I think it's like what Jen says, they know what they're doing here. I think they're trying to get people talking. They're trying to shock us. Well, it's worked. There are some positives, some minor positives. I think Grace Van Patten, we were talking about this earlier, it's an impossible role because you are playing a character who, as Jen says, is just inherently unlikable. And even as the police are, you know, they are abusing her and they're abusing Raphael too, but she's not making it easy. You know, she does kind of make light of the situation at times. And I think for Grace Van Patten, it's almost, I don't know what the director might have said to Grace. You know, you have to play someone who is charming enough to make friends and to kind of have a life here, but you also have to be so charmless that the police suspect you of murdering this person. That is impossible. And I think she handles it as well as you could. Other cast members, however, and this pains me to say this because she is such a talented performer, writer and creator, such brilliant at television. Sharon Horgan is so miscast here. It's her the American accent just doesn't work. She can't hold on to it. She's just not right for the role. It's a bit of a disaster, Rick.
I'm interested because when I was watching this, the thought that I had was, so Amanda Knox is one of the executive producers on this. She's one of the people behind this TV show. So in essence, what we're watching is an authorized biography of somebody. Surely there is the space for this is the insight into how the Italian police treated her at the time and into how she suffered at the hands of the police and was then in jail for 4 years. It almost kind of... It doesn't get lost, but it certainly is not the focus of what we see, certainly in the beginning.
It's not. And it's a retreading of a story we know extremely well because Amanda Knox herself has fronted and initiated documentaries, podcasts, 2 books, regular live appearances. And I get it's a strange field to be in, to turn the worst years of your life into a career. And I know that that's forced upon people because she is sitting in this very strange space of celebrity. She's more notorious than famous in a way. So I understand that's taking the claim on your own story. And I understand we're living in a time where a lot of women in the public eye want to reclaim their stories. And sometimes it's done well, where we have seen with Monica Lewinsky, who was also an executive producer on this show in the Ryan Murphy American Crime Story impeachment. It's done well like that. Other times with Pamela Anderson, where they co-opted that for Disney, it was done terribly. And I get that this is what we're trying to do, is retrace this story and think about why do we treat women that are maybe unlikable very differently. But at the same time, Amanda Knox has done this many times before. And also the way that the story is done with this Grace Van Patten is this manic pixie dream girl presented as such. I find that really offensive. And the story of Amanda Knox is not like the story of Belle Gibson. It's not like the story of Anna Delvey or Elizabeth Holmes. We're not in the territory of Grifton, which lends itself, I think, more readily to exaggerated, almost camp whimsy. I mean, Amanda Knox was arrested for murder. A woman died at the end of all this. And I still think it's not about her. It's never about her, and she's the voice that is absent. And this is Amanda Knox's tale yet again.
Hmm. Chris, is there a positive to this summer? Because obviously both of you seem to have not taken to this series at all.
No, I mean, the only positive I took from it was Grace Van Patten's performance, again, tasked with the impossible and just about makes something of it. But you could forgive all of that if the series had something to say about the injustices that happened here. And maybe, you know, and if it did, you know, give Meredith characters, you know, if it gave Meredith character herself a voice in this, but it doesn't really. And you forgive it too if the dialogue was better. But you heard from the clip there, sometimes it sounds as if it's been channeled through artificial intelligence. And it's full of wishy-washy. I mean, you have Grace Van Patten as Amanda Knox providing narration, and at one stage describes the murder and also her, you know, being forced into a false confession. That situation she describes as a sticky, tricky situation. That is just not good enough. And then it's full of things that, you know, full of lines that I think maybe the writers thought, you know, sound cool, but mean nothing. Like, if the, does truth exist if no one believes it? That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So I think, again, the only positive, Grace Van Patten, everything around us, it's just, I don't think anyone comes out of this looking well.
Stars from you.
1.5 out of 5, I think, is probably too fair.
Yeah. Jen?
I'd have to agree, because I think, you know, there's such an uneasiness. I felt so uneasy watching this. I felt so uncomfortable watching this. And I don't think that was the aim. I think the aim was to come out of it going, well, I understand her, Amanda Knox better now. But, I mean, I didn't.
Okay, let's move on swiftly. Last Tuesday's programme, I spoke to the writer Matt Charman about our next drama, Hostage, and to Saran Jones, who plays the British Prime Minister, Abigail Dalton. It's a political thriller from Netflix. Jen, where are we here?
Yeah, I mean, it's looking a lot like autumn already with this fair. I mean, what signifies the changing of the season better than Saran Jones with a sharp bob looking perplexed? Her eyebrows do a lot of work in this show, and I like that. So Hostage is the latest, it's a flashy Netflix thriller. It's almost this midway point between Bodyguard and The Diplomat, which is, I mean, it's like they just threw them in a blender and threw a little bit of flavour in there as well. So she's having a bad time as Prime Minister, unfortunately, Abigail Dalton. Just 8 months into her role, she's facing these two major crises. She has attempted to fix the faltering economy. She's cut the UK's military budget by huge numbers, and the cabinet are not happy about that. And then additionally, the NHS is facing this supply chain crisis. Pharmacies across the country, their shelves are bare. There's people queuing up for emergency medicine that they need and they're not getting it. So the citizens are in revolt almost. And then Dalton is meeting with this French president, Vivienne Toussaint, and she's played by Julie Delpy so well. She's a very sub Le Pen mode, I would say. And then amid all these negotiations about refugees and getting medical aid from France, Dalton's husband, Dr. Alex Anderson, played by Ashley Thomas, and his team of doctors have been taken hostage in French Guyana.
Okay, let's take something from it. This is Abigail's daughter, Sylvie, receiving a video message from the kidnappers, played by Saran Jones and Isabel Akwedike.
Is it Grandad? It's a video from Dad. Why does he look like that?
Mum! Mum! Aisha!
Mum, what's going on?
I need you to listen to me. We think your dad and his team may have been abducted, but we're trying to locate
them. Why? They're just doctors.
We don't know, but we're going to do everything that we can. I'm so sorry.
Give it back.
MI6.
I want to see him. Give it back.
It needs analysing. It's Alex.
Let me see it. Give it back.
We need to let them watch it first.
OK. Come here. Come here. Come here. Come here.
Okay, Chris, so the British Prime Minister then turns to the French right-wing president, played by Julie Delpy, to help her out of the crisis. How does that go?
She does. She says, Vivian, I need your help, but I'm not going to tell any of the cabinet about what's going on, despite the fact that they could probably help. I'm not going to make any sort of press conference about this, despite the fact that the public could probably help. And Vivian says, yes, but Vivian has some terms and conditions. And she, among them, yeah, I won't spoil some things for viewers, but she wants French troops on British soil to police the UK borders, which obviously Abigail is not happy about. But if she can, you know, help save the husband, let's go for it. The only thing is, just when it looks like Alex might be rescued, and this is all just in the first episode, we're not even going too far into this. Mm-hmm. Vivian gets a text, and I would love to tell you what is in the text, because it's a scandal so big and a blackmailing so shocking that I applauded it. I mean, that is how ridiculous it is.
I think also not revealing anything. I saw the same thing and thought, isn't that an average day for a French politician?
Okay. Listeners are going to be so intrigued now.
It was not a gif.
No. And then the text suddenly vanished as well. I think everyone is enjoying themselves here. And let's be clear, there is a huge difference between a terrible show like The Twisted Tale of Amanda Knox and a terribly enjoyable show like Hostage, because we're talking about a political thriller that knows it's outrageous, knows it's far-fetched, and has, you know, lead performers like Julie Delpy and Saran Jones just dialing everything up to 11. And I was on board with that. I mean, you could poke holes in it. You could say the spouse of a prime minister is supposed to have bodyguards.
Why are they in a danger zone?
Exactly. Why are they kidnapped? How is the kid of a prime minister allowed to just walk in during the middle of a tense negotiation with terrorists? The security here is just terrible. But it's Saran Jones. It's a five-part thriller where no episode runs longer than 45 minutes. I'm in.
Jen, okay, poke holes in it for me. So you've got the opportunity here with two strong women in very powerful positions.
Yes.
It's a great opportunity to explore things like excess media scrutiny on women in politics and misogyny. Does it do any of that?
It does. Like, I mean, look, this is shallow water we're in here. So it's not about examining socio-political issues all that deeply, but you do have this storyline where, because it's two women and world leaders, and they're struggling under that media microscope, and their own colleagues' misogyny and their private lives are being used to undermine their professional work. And that's interesting, but it's not really delved into. It's not a characterization story. These are all used just to propel that plot along, and it moves like a train. So it moves at light speed. And that's what people, I think it's not an issues-based show. And that kind of disappointed me, because I love Saran Jones. I've loved her since, you know, she was Karen and Corrie, chasing Tracy with her shoe. I loved her in Dr. Foster, where she nearly breaks Jodie Comer's face over the dinner table. Like, she's so good at that rage, that manifest rage, a female rage that I love. Now, she gets to boss around in a trouser suit. That's great for me. But you're not seeing, you could see so much better. It's just a little bit more writing, a little bit more depth between the two actresses would make this really sizzle. But as it is, it's just, I don't know, it's just a fun time, I guess.
I think it's so funny, because if this was on BBC on a Sunday night, which is usually Saran Jones home around this time of the year, there would be another 20 minutes and maybe it would delve into all of that. But it is so fast, it flies along, and it's so confidently assembled that I'm just incapable of awarding anything less than 3 stars, to be honest.
Because there is, you're right, there's a very deliberate decision has been made here. I'm also all on board for it, for 40-minute episodes, 41, 42-minute episodes, as opposed to what we see happening with some series where episodes can trail over an hour, and you do feel like they maybe should have left it a little bit earlier and we all would have been happier.
Yeah, get out hands clean. But, I mean, still, there's enough cliffhangers there to keep you engrossed and keep you jumping to the next episode. So it says something about the way it's constructed, but it's kind of constructed almost like a video game sometimes, I thought.
It is a little bit.
But enjoyably so.
And there's some nice performances amongst the supporting characters as well.
I mean, there is. I mean, you have James Cosmo as her sainted father, who is in hospital, and he gets to do a lot of head shaking and despair at his daughter's life, and why won't she just answer the phone to him? But then you also have someone like Jenny Beth, who I think is really good, and she's come along so much as an actress, and we also know her as a singer and performer, and she's has a really good role in this, and I can't give away too much about it, but she's part of the French invasion, if you like. And yeah, I mean, it's not going to change your world. I think it's one of those things that you will watch. You'll watch all of it and you'll gobble it up, but I don't think you'll remember it. if you know, unfortunately. Yeah. Okay. And I can live with that.
It's funny, I thought James Cosmo was actually so good in it that I believed him. He's supposed to be a dying man, but when he sees something on the television, he's up, walking over the television, let's turn it up. Martin McCann is in there. I won't say what role he's playing, the Northern Irish actor, but but he's delivering the goods. And also Lucy Amamati as Kofi, who is the top advisor for Sir Anne Jones' Prime Minister.
I think he's great.
And there's a good story there too, because they don't trust one another. And this is like the biggest moment of you know, and certainly the most dangerous moment of not just their career, but of her life. And the two of them are fighting over what decisions to make. You could build an entire series just around the two of those.
Yeah, and I'd like to see that.
Yeah.
I think people might not necessarily recognise his name, but he's one of those guys from TV that you look at him and think, I've seen him in things before. Okay, let's do stars for this, Chris.
Watch it. You'll have a great time. You might forget then it ever existed, but while it's on, you'll have fun with it. 3 stars.
Okay.
Yeah. Solid 3. I'd love to give more for Sir Anne Jones, but we need more of her. That's the thing.
This is true.
Okay, one more show to look at this week. We'll do it after these. You're listening to Friday Night's Arena. We are looking at TV, our third series. We're previewing it tonight. It's a new historical drama that starts on BBC One this Sunday. Rather, it's the story of events that led to the Battle of Hastings in 1066, which is all I know about the Battle of Hastings, with James Norton playing Harold Godwinson of Wessex and Nikolai Coster-Waldau as William of Normandy in King and Conqueror. Chris, it's an epic drama about a famous battle that changes the course of British history, and it starts smack bang in the middle.
It does. And do you want me to give you a history lesson now? I'll explain everything behind.
I would have
found
it helpful when I was watching the first episode. I would.
That's true, yeah, because we do actually start, I know we need to be careful about this, but the director Baltasar Kormákur, who knows a thing or two about directing action films, he does start with the Battle of Hastings and shows us, you know, James Norton's William and Nicolas Coster-Waldau.
James Corden's William would have been a much different.
Oh my God, that's a show I do not want to
James
see.
Norton did actually want to play William, but he is Harold, he's the nobleman. Then we've got Nicolas Coster-Waldau's William already emerged in battle. So we know how this story ends, but we need to go back maybe 10, 20 years to see how it begins. And it's basically exploring two men who were at the beginning allies, and how William came to England, first of all, to see King Edward crowned, King Edward here portrayed by Eddie Marson. And that's when he crossed paths with James Norton's Harold, who at the time was a nobleman, and his father, played by Jeff Bell, playing the Earl of Wessex as a bit of a gangster figure, had made some sort of deal with King Edward's mother that, you know, some sort of land deal. The details are a little bit complicated, but as soon as, and it also involves the Earl of Wessex's daughter marrying King Edward.
You're doing a bang up job.
I hope so. I'm trying to stumble over myself here. But as soon as Edward gets that crown, they thought that, you know, the Earl of Wessex thought everything was going to be okay. There's treachery up ahead. The two boys are going to be friends, but then also, you know, they're at one stage they're going to fall out. We're basically, Rick, on our way to the Battle of Hastings. I hope I haven't messed things up there.
No, that's pretty good. Let's take a clip from fairly early on. This is when William of Normandy's wife, Matilda, informs him that he has a royal invitation to go to England to a coronation, played by Clemence Posey and Nikolai Coster-Waldau.
You've received an invitation.
To where?
England. Your cousin Edward is the new king. He's about to be crowned. You've been invited to the coronation.
You want me to travel all the way to it?
Apparently they do. When did you last have any word from them?
I don't think I've ever had word from them. I knew them briefly when they were here in exile. But Edward and I were just children.
What do you think they want?
No idea. What do I know of England?
Jen, what do you think of the two main characters here, Harold and William?
Yeah, Harold and William. I think James Norton, he's playing this as this very obvious heroic. It has shades of everything from Braveheart to Gladiator. It's very atypical. He is a good lord. He is a nice man. He loves his wife. And, you know, he doesn't exactly want the crown. It's not until, I suppose, we move into it later that you see this life is thrust upon him. So he's this accidental almost hero in some ways. And I don't know if it's got historical accuracy, let's just say, because I mean, I just don't think. But then again, we don't really know what they were like back then. We have no idea.
There's a fair amount of modern dialogue in it.
Yes.
There's too much. It's completely anachronistic. It's crazy. There's a lot of back off, guys. And that is the feeling of the BBC staking their claim, going, we were here rolling in the mud first. Long before Game of Thrones, we had these historical epics that we used to roll out on a Sunday night, and they were the ones that would give you the horrors before you're thinking of going back to school. It's pure old school 1970s Robin Hood fare. I could almost hear Clannad in the background, but it's sexed up and souped up for the Game of Thrones generation. So it's these two distinct things mixed together, these two distinct genres that are mixed together. And I mean, I do think that Costa Waldo as well, he's kind of inscrutable. There's a moment that a dramatic moment that happens at one point with his newborn child, where you are thinking, what exactly is going on here? So he's hard to read. He's mean and moody. And I guess that's what they're playing either side of the map. And I think James Norton does a good job. I think he is one of those actors that is eternally watchable. What he is great at doing is being a bit of a bad boy. If you've seen his performance in War and Peace, I think that's absolutely brilliant. And that was a great BBC production. But I will say here, this is not your War and Peace. This is not Wolf Hall. This is not that kind of writing. If you're expecting it to be in depth and rich, it's more about lads going around swordplay.
Yeah, and that's a question. So, Chris, do the battles make up for it? I mean, even at the very beginning, the Battle of Hastings, it's got a slight bang of Kenneth Branagh's Henry V off it.
Yeah, or maybe even like a little bit of a Game of Thrones, Lord of the Rings sort of setup. There's not a lot of action, but there is some. You know, like it's so strange that I agree with Jen that not a lot of effort has gone into making this, you know, accurate for the time. Not a lot of effort has gone into the dialogue, which sounds a little bit too modern, but a lot of effort has gone into making the characters look as though they actually live in this time, because James Norton, I don't think, has a scene where you aren't looking at the screen going, just wipe that dirt off your face there. You know, you can actually, it's at times you can smell these men. So they do look as though they've been just in every scene, been, you know, are coming back from a battle. There's not a lot of action. I mentioned earlier that there's sort of a crime family feel, especially off the Earl of Wessex and his four children. And I think that's maybe why Jeff Bell has been brought in, because when you see Jeff Bell in anything, you think, well, he's definitely going to be involved in something dodgy here. So that might please some viewers. But I think you might be waiting around for the battle.
Okay, so for both of you, if people are looking for their fix of a big BBC Sunday night drama, is this worth a watch on Sunday evening?
I think you need to wiki what's going on beforehand. Yes. I think you needed one of those, you know, the scrolls like at the start of Star Wars. I felt like that's what we needed at the beginning of this over a muddy battlefield. But I do think the two leads are trying their best to wrangle this great hulking story of British history that a lot of people would be familiar with into something manageable that you can digest after your Sunday dinner. And it's admirable, but it's not exactly what I expected.
And Chris?
Yeah, I don't think it's prestige television, but it's such a shame that this is actually not going out on a streamer like Netflix, because if it was, you'd have Nicolaj and probably James give out this 3-minute explainer at the beginning just to give you a bit of a history lesson. So I agree. Maybe go off and have a read, keep a history book handy, but it's not the worst thing that any performer here has done.
Jen Gannon, Chris Wasser, thank you so much. As always, The Twisted Tale of Amanda Knox is streaming on Disney Plus. Hostage is available on Netflix, and King and Conqueror begins on BBC One on Sunday night. You're listening to Friday Night's Arena. Let's finish off our week with album reviews. Darlings of the Irish music scene, Kingfisher, are on a high at the moment with Electric Picnic and sold-out shows on the horizon. But what will our critics make of the debut album, Halcyon? I spoke to Theo Ellis of Wolf Alice earlier this week on the programme about the band's latest album, The Clearing, which is out today. Could it be the record that gives them true global appeal? And Australian artist Gordy has been around for ages. You've probably heard her work on a TV soundtrack near you, but she brings us her third studio album, Like Plasticine. Joining me this evening are Nadine O'Regan and Eamon Sweeney. Will start with Kingfisher and the album Halcyon. Nadine, formed 3 years ago in Limerick. Kingfisher have come a long way in a short time.
Yeah, they were studying engineering at the University of Limerick, and they began making music together. It was really, I think, a product of COVID and being bored. And, you know, some bands just seem to have it naturally. They have such a natural, easy sound. They remind me of, oh, there are elements of Mumford & Sons in the sound. I guess that sort of banjo diddly eye element, and then also a band like maybe the Coronas, and then We Banjo 3. And they've, you know, they're hugely steeped in traditional melodies as well. They have been received with open arms by the Irish community and further afield. I mean, to think that they're already going to be playing two sold out dates at the Three Arena. They've got, as you mentioned, Electric Picnic coming up next weekend. And this album, I mean, it is a long record, actually. It's 16 tracks, 53 minutes, much longer than your average debut. But this is clearly the work of a band who are bursting with, you know, ideas and the desire to show us what they can do.
Yeah, I mean, it is one of those unusual things in that they do seem to have just exploded out of nowhere. They've got the gigs here as well. But the US, mainland Europe as well, they seem to be making big inroads there.
Yeah, it's kind of shocking. But I do know that, like, on mainland Europe, some of the dates that they've sold out and they appear to be very big in Germany. And it reminds me of when I lived in Germany for a while. And without being too dismissive, their taste would not be particularly good. And when it came to Irish music...
That sounds incredibly dismissive.
Yes, it is. And yeah, it's, I'm just kind of stating a fact, I believe. I was there at the height of, you know, the Kelly family mania. And some of the so-called trad music that you find in Germany. But anyway, point aside, yeah, it is. It's striking a chord, but I think it's a mass market chord. You know, just because McDonald's sells a lot of Big Macs doesn't mean it's the best beef. Starbucks sells a lot of coffee, but it's really bad coffee. And I think, I genuinely think this is really awful bad music.
Okay, very early on, straight out of the traps. Killer is maybe the song that people might know off the album. It's been a top 10 hit for them for weeks and weeks and weeks in the Irish charts. It's the opening track on the album. Let's take a listen to it.
For the parish to last evermore.
That's Kingfisher, and that's the big single that's been number one, called Killer. Nadine, as you're listening to the album, this is the song that almost sounds like it doesn't belong with the rest of them, but there's a reason for that.
Yeah, because it wasn't really meant to be a sincere song. You know, when they started writing it, they say themselves, they ran it off in 15 or 20 minutes. They were writing about local spots. They thought it was a bit of a joke, and it was honestly meant to be just a heart and sleeve tribute to hurling, but no more than that. Kind of a thing that would be a bit of a ditty, you know, and it clearly, as you hear, it leans on very traditional melodies and sounds quite derivative, because it's intentionally quite derivative. It's meant to be one of those things that you can, you know, like, you got the la 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 chorus, you've got everything that you need to make a song very instantly hummable, I guess. But they really didn't, I think they were almost a bit embarrassed about it, but then it just sort of took off. And look, if a song takes off, what are you going to do? You got to go with it.
We've got a text in already. That's very harsh, lads. I think Kingfisher are super and should be admired for getting themselves to this level so quickly. Lads making music and having a good time doing it, they come across as decent, honest, grounded and delighted with the opportunity. Thank you, Anne and Limerick.
I would agree with that, actually. And I don't have the same opinion on the album as Eamon does, I should say. What I hear here is the sound of three guys in their 20s who are clearly very able, confident musicians who work very well together, who are clearly, I haven't seen them live yet, but like, if they're able to get fans to Three Arena, then they are doing something right. And this album, yes, it's overlong. Yes, there's aspects of it where you could say, look, you need to customise your sound a bit more. Some songs are echoes or retreads of other songs. But at the same time, there's a genuine energy. And I think there's also a capacity for contemplative lyrics that works. I know Eamon is looking looking over me going, have you lost your mind?
He's hovering.
He's hovering. But then while the song was playing, you admitted that, you know, Mumford and Sons, how do you feel about Mumford and Sons?
They're one of the worst bands of all time.
Okay.
I generally think that. And
okay, so here's the question. This is a debut album. Are you being a bit harsh on them?
Yeah, I am. But the reason I'm being harsh is I tried to give this a chance, multiple listens. When it starts, Man on the Moon, nothing to do with the REM track, by the way, I kind of go, okay, this is not going to be so bad. But God, it is. It's the vocal. There's two instruments that just really I hate when they're done badly. And it's the banjo and the saxophone. And there's just too much banjo in this. Mumford and Sons, Ed Sheeran is kind of responsible. That Galway girl, this horrible, bland, O'Carroll's souvenir shop, Irish trad for people. Like, they'd run a mile from Lancome because it's too gothic and weird. And actually, good traditional music is just too raw or something. So this kind of sanitised, just kind of horrible, safe, bland, bad music works. You know, bad music can sell. You know, we don't... And listen, they could be great lads. I would say congratulations. You've sold out the Tree Arena twice. You're going to be doing Malahide Castle next year. Well done, but I won't be going.
Niddy.
That's me.
Niddy. Okay, well, I'm going to play a little clip of Man on the Moon in just a second. You like that as well?
Yeah.
Tell me about it.
Well, one of the reasons I liked it is because it starts with a line on, I think he mentions how he's on the internet, he's putting his life on the internet and he doesn't really know why. And it's a very sort of immediately sort of, I suppose, recognisable lyric for a lot of people. And it gets to the heart for me of why I think this band work as well as they do, which is that they're accurately reflecting what it feels like to be in your 20s. And even if, yes, there are some anodyne moments on the record, lyrically, I think there are also moments that get across, I suppose, the vagueness and insecurity of just growing up in this era.
Okay, let's take a little bit of it. And that's Man on the Moon, Kingfisher, from the debut album. Let's get stars. Nadine?
I think it's a debut. I think they're doing really well. I think they're talented. 3.5 stars.
Eamon?
I've got one.
Thought so.
Yeah.
Mercury Music Prize winners Wolf Alice are back with their fourth studio album, The Clearing. The record is being seen as their play to get a bigger audience with a label move from the 1975's Dirty Hit to Sony. Nadine, Wolf Alice are hugely successful at this point, but people might not necessarily know who they are. So remind us.
Yeah, so Wolf Alice are proof, I think, that you can be absolutely massive in music in 2025 and also be very much under the radar. They've won the Mercury Prize and they really have won or been nominated for almost every award going. They've even been in the Michael Winterbottom film, On the Road. And they're one of these bands that their fans are just absolutely euphoric about them, but those fans remain like almost cultish in their devotion. And so it's quite interesting that for this record, Wolf Alice have actually moved record label to Sony, and they were very clear about their aim for that. They want to give everyone who loves music the opportunity to at least hear them and decide if they love them or hate them. So it's kind of a question of distribution as well. They were with Dirty Hit, and I think they felt that they weren't being given the time that they needed. So this particular album was recorded with Greg Kirsten, who's worked with Beck and is a very highly regarded producer. There was a long gestation process, and lyrically you can really hear the intent in all, you know, they're so considered. This is obviously an album that they really hope will break them in a worldwide way.
Okay, let's take a little bit from the new Wolf Alice album, The Clearing. This is called The Sofa. That's Wolf Alice, and it's the Sofa. I talked to Theo from the band earlier this week here in Arena, and he was talking very fondly about recording it in LA with Greg Kirsten, the producer. Maybe, Eamon, talk to me a little bit about the impact that you think that has had on the sound here.
Yeah, it's very, very polished. Now, to give a bit listeners a bit of context, Greg Kirsten has worked with Foo Fighters, Adele, Jonas Brothers, Ellie Goulding, big, you know, premier rock pop acts. What I think really the unique selling point for Wolf Alice really is Ellie Roswell. She's a great front woman. She's got a great voice. You get echoes of Susie Sue, Kate Bush. She can do kind of soft and complex, and she can be just kind of just really catchy and pop. What first got me, the first song of Wolf Alice that I really paid attention to was back on their first album. They had a track called Silk that Danny Boyle and Irvin Welsh used for the Trainspotting 2 trailer. I go, what the hell is this? It's brilliant. It's very minimal, kind of torch song. They've really, like, this is a reason I like the album, dislike it slightly. Like, it is everything in the kitchen sink kind of thing. It's kind of big sounding, it's polished. It's the aforementioned Greg Kirsten. For the most part, it works, but as a whole, from as a start to finish, I don't think it's a banger.
Nadine, what do you make of Ellie Russell's vocals on this? I mean, if people saw her at Glastonbury, they saw the set on TV, they'll know what she's capable of.
Yeah, her vocals are extraordinary in a technical sense because at one level, for a long time, she's been, you know, a very capable indie pop rock vocalist. But on this particular record, it's like she's gone kind of widescreen on us. And one minute she's doing what she always does, which is the indie rock thing. And the next minute, it's like she's just pulled the canvas away from you and suddenly you're in a new world where she's delivering this kind of elastic, operatic kind of level of vocal. And at one level, it's highly technically impressive. And at another level, it's a little bit disorientating and confusing. So you find yourself thinking, wow, but also, do I like it? And then there's this 1970s sort of overlay through the record, which is really very, very important in the context of listening to this record, because you really need to think about their influence a lot of the time. And they talked about how they listened or they watched Get Back, the Beatles documentary, and were highly influenced by that, and there's a very Beatles-esque kind of vibe here. But then I'm also thinking of bands like Rilo Kiley, which, you know, I wouldn't necessarily have expected to hear. And actually, there's almost like little fragments of Elliott Smith in there in terms of how the production is used at particular points, you know, whispered into your ear and then removed and then disembodied. And it's all very, very technical and very interesting at one level. And then at another level, a bit discombobulating as well.
I think this is a really interesting song to play off the album to illustrate maybe some of those points that you were just making. This is White Horses. That's White Horses from Wolf Alice from the album The Clearing. They talk about channeling bands like ELO and Fleetwood Mac. There's definitely at least one song on this album that has a Steely Dan thing running through it as well. I can hear Kate Pearson from the B-52s on that.
Yeah. This is my favourite song. Like this song is the one that's going on the forever Spotify playlist. And it's funny that it's actually sees drummer Joel Amey take on lead vocals before he shares them and it goes into this duet. But there's just something about this particular track that feels very cohesive. And, you know, we were saying while it was playing a little bit, it's of the time, but also feels quite current as well.
Yeah, I think this is the one, and me and Nadine would be in complete agreement on this record, I think, rather than the first one. For there, like you mentioned, B-52s, and I get total Susie Sue and Spellbound and that kind of thing. And they're kind of their ambition to do this modern Fleetwood Mac ELO thing. I think it's mixed results, but they nail it on this. This is really, really good, top drawer. I think they're just a little bit away from greatness, but there's definitely hints of it.
You can always text us on 51551. Thank you to the anonymous texter who said, I felt thoroughly cool when I was able to tell a 20-something in a store what the song White Horses was today. I'm really enjoying the album. For both of you, Nadine, stars?
I could be being generous, but I am going to give it 3.5.
I'll go 3. Not quite, but yeah. Let's not go there anymore. Compared to, let's say, the first one.
We've moved on.
We've moved on, exactly, Rick.
That is Wolf Alice. The album is The Clearing, and we'll take a look at something else after this. And you're listening to Friday Night's Arena. Finally, Like Plasticine, the third album from the Australian artist Gordy. Let's have a listen to the single Peripheral Lover. You're playing unfair. That's Peripheral Lover from Gordy. Nadine, Gordy has a certain profile thanks to the songs that have turned up on TV, but she's a new discovery for you, and she was for me as well.
Yeah, and she's the kind of person who's turned up on these Spotify playlists because she's had a single that featured in The Vampire Diaries, she's another single in The Walking Dead, and yet she'd be considered something of an underground artist, but she has amazing collaborators. She's worked with Phoebe Bridgers, Bon Iver and Troye Sivan, and she's one of those people that, like, I'm so glad to have discovered this record because it's really confident in its exploration of identity and its exploration of her own identity, queer identity, relationships. But she manages to communicate all that through synthy pop and alt pop that is both very sprightly at times. There's some good hooks there, but then there's also some really low-key, impactful, beautiful moments. She's also a medical doctor and she worked through COVID. And so some of what she experienced is reflected, particularly in one track track with Anais Mitchell, which is very strong.
It's a fairly extraordinary piece of information, which again I found out when I was researching the album. Eamon, it's an atmospheric album. It's got a lot going on in it. What did you make of it?
Musically, I thought that there's very lovely, atmospheric, great sound to it. My main problem with it, I love the pop bangers. I love the atmospherics, but I thought there's just this over-reliance on that Bono Iver style, vocoder, treated vocal, that kind of game. And when there's a track called Cutting Room Floor, which is done a lot more straight, we can hear her voice more. She's got a great voice. I don't know what she's trying to hide. Maybe that really is an honest reflection. I don't think she's kind of trying to go, oh, I need all this, you know, to be like Bon Iver. It's as Nadine is saying, what I do like about this record, there is a refreshing honesty to it of I'm not so certain. And I think that kind of duet that works with Soke is fantastic too.
Yeah, Soke is on the record as well. It's amazing.
And apparently it dates back. She seems to be a long-term fan of Derry Soke because she saw her, I think, in Australia in 2014 or something. And if memory serves me correctly, that's more or less when Bridie was just starting out. So it's fascinating to see the influence that she's had in this. The Sonics are great. I just think a little bit more of her own identity. I think she's kind of maybe been in the shadow of Bon Iver and obviously taken a lot from him. And that kind of Bon Iver sound, I think, kind of in a lot of American alt music and that whole thing of kind of folktronica, that gives me... There's something about that word.
You must note, Eamon is wearing a Mogwai t-shirt.
I like my music kind of very raw, shall we say. So read into that what you will about what I thought about something. Anyway, we've kind of gone beyond that.
Did you have any concerns about the vocals, Nadine?
Not really. I think it's interesting how she approaches the vocals sometimes. There were points when she dropped down her vocal and made it sort of disembodied and very male. And I thought she played around with it a little bit. There is maybe a tiny bit too much vocoder at times, but I could feel the vulnerability of her vocal as it moved through the record, and really for me that's all I need to feel that I'm hearing. And actually she wrote some notes for herself when she was making the record, and she just said in the top corner of her notebook, inject emotion into everything. And I think you can feel that. I think she's a storyteller, and this record accurately reflects the point that she's currently at in her life, and I like to see that in a record. I like to come out feeling like I've, you know, been through that experience with somebody at that moment.
Yeah, I think we have to take a little bit of the song on the album that Soke is the guest artist on. This is called Lunch at Dune. All my galaxies in your grasp. Don't abandon that I hold last one. And that's all we can take of it, unfortunately, because time is getting on us. Lunch at Dune, that is from Like Plasticine, the Gordy album. Thoughts, stars from both of you, Nadine?
Really work for me, 4 stars.
She's definitely getting there. I'm kind of coming to it knowing nothing about her. So I'm almost listening to it. It's almost like a debut album. I'd probably listen to some of the old stuff, but someone I would pay attention to in the future. Not quite there yet, I think. So 3 for me.
Okay, if you're looking for the names of the albums tonight, we played you Kingfisher. Their new album is called Halcyon, their debut, Wolf Alice's The Clearing. And that's Like Plasticine from Gordy, Nadine O'Regan, and Eamon Sweeney. Thank you very much for coming in on Arena tonight.